Welcome to a special Credo edition of the Crossroads podcast at Fifth Avenue Presbyterian Church. I'm Jamie Staley, Director of Christian Education. This month, in a series of four podcasts, I will be joined by members of our clergy to explore some of the theological foundations of our faith by delving into four modern creeds from our Book of Confessions. The Book of Confessions is a collection of historical documents and statements of faith that articulate the beliefs and doctrines of the Presbyterian Church USA. It serves as a guidepost for our spiritual journey and communal identity. I hope you can join us as we explore these creeds each week and their relevance to our lives today, seeking deeper understanding and insight into our shared Christian heritage. I'm here today with Reverend Dr. Scott Black Johnston, who is our senior pastor. And Scott's credo for this year was on the Theological Declaration of Barmen. So thank you, Scott, for joining me. This is, as I think you know, one of my favorite creeds, and I know it's one of your favorites. So I'm really excited to have you here today to talk to us about what this means, where it came from, and what it means for us today. So thank you so much for joining me.
It's great to be here, Jamie, and I'm looking forward to talking about Barmen.
So just to get us started, can you tell us a little bit about the history? What was going on? Where did this Theological Declaration of Barmen come from?
So I'm going to try to keep this as brief as possible because this is the kind of thing that could easily absorb 5 hours of commentary, because the historical background to Barmen is the rise of National Socialism in Germany. And so the way to keep this succinct is to say that when Hitler came to power, he made a few aborted attempts at coming to power, including one that got him arrested and convicted as a traitor. And that's when he went into prison and wrote Mein Kampf. But it was really in 1933 when Hitler, who was in the Reichstag, was named chancellor by the German president, Hindenburg. And when he came into power, he quickly moved to begin consolidating all the levers of power in Germany to himself and to his cronies. And they actually had a name for the overall grabbing of power called Gleichschaltung, which was to control all aspects of German society. And they had a specific term for the way that they were going to get the church under the thumb of National Socialism. And they called that the Kirchenkampf, the battle for the church, or the church war. It was interesting, this all happened very quickly in the course of 1933. It's really remarkable how quickly the Nazis, who had received about 44% of the popular vote in the parliamentary elections, then became the only legal political party and exerted power over all the institutions of German society. The way that they approached the church to get control of the church, and I suppose I should answer the question, why did they want to control the church? Because the answer to that is fairly straightforward. The church was a source of potential dissent against what the Nazis were trying to do. And the way that they approached the church was to provide support and then to make use of a movement known as the German Christian Movement. The German Christian Movement was a subset of German Christianity that liked some of the aspects of the Nazi project. They liked the idea of a Germany that was renewed, that had pride, dignity once again. They felt, you know, the shame and the economic punishment of World War II was just unfair, and they wanted to recover from that and to embrace a Christianity that was uniquely German. And Hitler saw this movement and took somebody out of that movement, a guy named Ludwig Müller, and really gave him the goal of bringing the church under the control of the Nazi Party. And Müller had a clear program for how he wanted to go about it, and a number of things that he wanted to see happen. Amongst them are these. He wanted to see there be no clergy who had any ancestral connections to Judaism, no Judaism in their family tree. They were not married to a Jewish person. They agreed to, you know, support the Reich in their preaching and speaking. He also wanted to edit the Bible. He wanted to take out the Old Testament and the writings of the Apostle Paul. Why Paul? Because Paul was a rabbi. I guess he forgot the fact that Jesus was a rabbi as well. But they wanted to get rid of Paul's writings, get rid of the Old Testament. So they wanted to focus on a certain picture of Jesus. And they actually talked this way. They said, we want to emphasize the Aryan qualities of Jesus, make Jesus a heroic kind of German figure who would be bold and victorious in fighting against the powers of evil and in fighting against the Jews. And so this is the sort of church that Müller was trying to bring into existence. And it was as that project got further and further along, they actually had a vote. Hitler promised the people a vote to vote about the leaders of the new German church. And the vote took place at churches all across. There were 18,000 Protestant churches, Lutheran, we would say today, in Germany, 18,000 Protestant churches. And each of the churches was a polling place for people to vote on the new leaders of the new church. And there were candidates. And Hitler went on the radio and said, it's your patriotic duty, in a fiery speech. It's your patriotic duty. This is in the summer of 1933. To vote for the German Christian candidate at your local church, to go to vote and to vote German Christian. And so when the election results came in, then German Christian swept the board. And it was that was really the final straw that brought, of the 18,000 churches, it's estimated that 15,000 were fully in support of the Reich and about 3,000 were dissenters. And out of those 3,000 or so dissenting churches, there were clergy who formed an organization called the Emergency Pastors Group and an organization called the Confessing Church that were going to embrace the classic confessions of the church. This was important because one of the things that Müller was advancing was the notion that the Führer was a new revelation. The resistance found that abhorrent, as they should. They found abhorrent the fact that the church was really trying, that the German Christian movement was trying to put the Führer in the place of Jesus Christ. In fact, the German constitution, the church constitution that they passed in 34, the first line of it is the Führer is the head of the church. And Müller himself was declared the bishop of the German Christian Church, the Reich Bishop, in 34. Anyway, sorry, lots of dates and stuff flying at you, but the key thing is to set the stage for Barman. And in the Barman Declaration, what happens is Karl Barth and Hans Asmundsen and Thomas Bright went to the city of Barmen, which is a little bit east of Dusseldorf, in May of 1934. And they were sent ahead these three theologians to write a confessional statement for the confessing church, a statement of resistance. And they agreed that it should be a confessional statement. They agreed that the structure should be a structure in which they quote scripture, make a theological point, and then state what they reject in the current German Christian movement or in the current German society. So it's a series of six rejections are basically what Bormann is. It's not long. It's a two-page document. You can look it up online and you can read it in less than 10 minutes for sure. And it was Bork who drafted this. And I always like to tell people that the story that I was told, which I'm sticking by it until somebody, you know, proves me wrong, is that it was late in the day, it was hot. The other guys that Bart was with wanted to take a nap. He said, fine. He took a handful of cigars and a fifth of whiskey and went to, and his typewriter up to his room and banged the Bormann Declaration out. And then that afternoon, they made a few edits. They presented it to the conference in Bormann, and it was unanimously embraced by the conference. And that's how we ended up with the Bormann Declaration.
Wow. Something that you mentioned earlier that I thought was really fascinating, it was just brief, but, you know, talking about they're calling themselves the Confessing Church and how important the confessions were to them and kind of, you know, how that relates to us looking at confessions today, why these are important to us. I just thought that was really interesting. Would you mind just touching on that for a second?
Yeah. So, you know, within the Presbyterian Church, our Book of Confessions stretches all the way back to the Apostles' Creed and the Nicene Creed, Scots Confession, the Second Helvetic Confession, creeds that were written, you know, first century, you know, third and fourth century, in the midst of the Reformation, the Second Helvetic Confession, post-Reformation, you know, and in the modern era, the Confession of 1967, the Brief Statement of Faith, the confessions are always the attempt of the church to respond faithfully, and I'm going to say, use this word, to a crisis in either in the church or in the culture in that moment. And so in responding to that crisis, they try to go back and to say, this is the core of the faith. And they felt like the core of the faith was under attack by the German Christian movement because they were picking and choosing, this is what we want, this is what we want, you know, cutting out, you know, like basically 80% of the Bible was going to end up on the cutting room floor. And I think that's an interesting thing to see what's happening when, you know, and in this case, I really mean it, evil forces are trying to exert control over the church, is that they want to get rid of any possible criticism, and they want to make their ideas or their person the sovereign. They want to put somebody in Christ's place. And that is something I think the Reformed Church has always been leery of. When somebody's trying to do that, it's like warning Will Robinson, you know, this is not good. So,
in the last 3 weeks, I've asked folks to get a copy of the Book of Confessions at some way. I know you can download it for free online. So folks, if you are able to get a copy of this in front of you, that would be great. I'm going to ask Scott next to kind of dive into it. So get ready. Scott, can you give us just four of your highlights from this confession?
Yeah. So the first highlight that I want to talk about is, it's going to seem like it's not like immediately apparent when you read the confession, but if you know the backstory that we just talked about, and if you know something about American governmental law, it'll make sense. And that is, we talk a lot about the separation of church and state. And I am constantly finding myself saying the reason why we talk about that, those words, by the way, are not in the Constitution. What is in the Constitution, however, is the Establishment Clause, you know, in the very First Amendment to the Constitution, which says that the government shall not, you know, establish a church. That's exactly what the Nazis were trying to do. They were trying to establish a church and make it the only church, a church that they had control over. And our own Constitution in its First Amendment says this is not a good idea. And I think that's the first thing in that I would point to is sort of an overarching comment about what Barman is saying is something that's very similar to the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which is look out. And it also takes me back to that comment about separation of church and state. A lot of times people will give me a hard time if I mention anything political, like, well, separation of church and state. I'm like, no, you haven't paid attention to the actual documents. That language exists to protect the church from the state. The church can still say what it thinks is good and true and righteous. You know, the church shouldn't attempt to take over the government. That would be, you know, a problem. But in terms of speaking, the church is supposed to speak the truth. And so that's not separation of church and state. Separation of church and state is state, don't try to take over churches when churches are saying things that you don't like. And that's what happened under fascism. So that's number one.
Yeah.
Number two, the sovereignty of God. If I were to say if there's a doctrine behind Barman, it's the doctrine of the sovereignty of God, which is a reform doctrine. And it says, you know, basically God is sovereign, nothing else is in our lives. And people, 95% of the time in this life, you can go around saying, oh yeah, of course, that's what the church says. God is the king, you know. But in moments like this, in moments like what happened in Germany, that assertion becomes not only countercultural, but almost traitorous to a regime like the Nazis, to say that it's God, not the Führer, but it's God. And my relationship with God and the God that I experienced through the confessions, you know, that the God that has been, you know, taught to me by the church, the God that I encounter in the Psalms, in the scriptures, in the hymns of the church, this is the one who reigns over my life. That's a powerful thing to say. And at times in life, it can be an extremely significant and risky thing to say. So that's number two. Number three, when I look at Barman, I hear again and again, you know, this statement kind of sticks with me. We reject the false doctrine that the church could have permission to hand over the form of its message and of its order in like its government to whatever itself might wish or to the vicissitudes of the prevailing ideological and political convictions of the day. And I like that. That's a sort of like, you know, it's a Psalm 1 kind of comment. You know, where are your roots? the church's roots, the church should not be, you know, pushed around the very way that the fascists pushed it around to say, oh, you ought to be in support of this. And in the case of the German Christians, it was this notion that the church ought to be a sort of terrible form of patriotism. That's what the church ought to be about. There's parts of it that we might agree with. Well, the German people ought to have dignity and pride. But then that quickly moves into, but we wanted the German people and the real German people, the Aryan people, and all these other people are a problem within our society. So it was an anti-diversity thing for sure, but it was also just a total corruption of what it means to be human, a child of God, you know, all that kind of stuff. So, what I would say is that rootedness of the church not being blown around by the winds of the time, that's a really important thing for Barman. And I guess the thing about Barman, Jamie, that you know, is that scares me the most, that's most important about it, is that to be on guard against history repeating itself. And I think that's why it's in our confessions, is to say, watch out. Again, that's the warning Will Robinson part of Barman, is when forces in a culture try to, you know, turn a church down these dark paths, it's a time to speak up. And I'm in great awe of those people that spoke up. I mean, you know, Martin Niemöller, who was one of those who spoke up, he ratified the Barman Declaration, you know, he spoke out against the German Christian movement, you know, ended up going to Dachau, the concentration camp. I talked about that before. Many people don't realize that Dachau had, you know, the priest's barracks, the pastor's barracks, and that there were close to 3,000 clergy who were imprisoned there. Most of them were Roman Catholic, but there were Protestants there as well. You know, these people paid a deep price. He did survive. Bonhoeffer did not. He was hanged. There were almost all of the folk and churches that supported Barman paid some kind of price, you know, for their support, and for declaring that. And I do think it's important to recognize, I don't know what to do exactly with the numbers here, but it is significant. I think, you know, a lot of people were like, well, where was the church in, you know, during the Holocaust? There were 3,000 churches that said, this is not right. And there were, you know, close to 3,000 clergy who were in concentration camps. It wasn't enough. And it is a reminder of how easy it is for the Christian movement to be co-opted by something awful. But there was significant resistance, which is why Hitler focused on this, because he knew it can be a really, really big problem for him.
Thank you for that. I do. I really appreciate the idea that, you know, these confessions are also reminders to look to not repeat mistakes of the past. I think that's in particular the story is behind this one. So thank you for that.
Yeah.
Friends at home, thank you so much for joining me the last 4 weeks for Credo. This has been a really fun journey looking at some of our modern creeds, and I hope you will join us for our next Crossroads podcast. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Crossroads. Our managing editor is Jamie Staley, and our editors are Vashina Brisbane and Emily Dombroff.